we ask the question, well, how did it get to that state? And we need to understand that there's a lot of forces at work in the world, and they're not just passive forces. There's very intentional, active forces at work where people are intentionally trying to do this. And really, I shouldn't say people are trying to do this, because ultimately it's Satan that's behind this, right? We read some passages earlier that talk about the fact that we're battling against spiritual wickedness in high places. And what we'll see here is that these high places include our governments and the world leaders that are pushing these things. And of course, it's Satan that is behind all of these things. And so we're looking at humanism to really help us be more aware of the methods that the devil is using to try to persuade all of us to go down this path to serve him. And we're seeing here that he's being very successful, and that there's a world full of people that are very committed to this kind of thinking. And we're seeing very intentional efforts being made to incorporate more and more people to have this kind of thinking. And so what we want to do here is, expose the methods that are being used to make folks aware. When you're taking your kids on outings or, in wherever they may go, you want to be on the lookout for phrases and things that they're going to run across, things that they may hear, books that they may read, shows that they may watch, all kinds of different forms of influence that they may face, and that, of course, it also affects each of us as well. And so we're going through this to really help make ourselves aware that there's a lot going on around us that maybe we weren't aware of before. And so a lot of this is trying to highlight some of these efforts. So last week we ended up on this quote from Charles Francis Potter. Charles Francis Potter, you might remember from last week, was an individual from New York State. He founded the first humanist society in New York. Does anybody remember what year? 1929. So it's been going on for quite some time. We'll see some other quotes here from folks that were born back in the 1700s that had this kind of a mindset. So this has been going on for a long, long time. But Charles Francis Potter founded the first humanist society of New York in 1929. And then what happened in 1933? Does anybody remember what was published? The first Humanist Manifesto, and there's been three. It seems like every 40 years they've published an update. So they have a manifesto 1, 2, and 3. I guess we get to wait for number 4, where they lay out this philosophy and what their goals are. But as we saw last week, their ultimate goal is to have a society without what? Without God. And that's their aim. And one of the methods, one of the chief methods that they recognized from the very beginning on how to bring that about was through the school systems. And here we see a quote from Charles Potter himself, who was a co-author of the manifesto back in 1933, where he says how powerful education is here. And he considers it to be an ally of humanism. And he thinks of that American schools as being a school of humanism. And he then compares it to, if we've got the kids in school for 5 days a week, there's no way that Sunday school can beat that. They get maybe an hour a week where the kids go to Sunday school. Meanwhile, they're hearing 5 days a week of this indoctrination of these humanist values. So which one do you think is going to win unless the parents are very, very careful to be pointing these things out to their children? And so they realize this from the get-go, and there's been a lot of effort to try to utilize the schools to teach humanism. Here we see another quote from Charles Potter again. This is how he views humanism. He says, it's not the abolition of religion, but the beginning of real religion. And then he says, it's by freeing religion of supernaturalism, it will release tremendous reserves of hitherto thwarted power. So Here's one of the founders of the humanist movement in the United States who considers it to be what he calls a real religion. It's gotten rid of God, who's this make-believe entity, and it's replaced it and now freed us as humans to go out and to do the things that we were originally intended to do. And that's how he's thinking of this. And sort of blasphemous statements here, right? Man has waited too long for God to do what man ought to do himself and is fully capable of doing. So here we see somebody that's completely, you know, an unbeliever in God and basically mocking, we've waited too long on God to do this. We need to do it ourselves. So we need to, again, recognize that these founders of humanistic thought, at least in our modern times, this thought really goes back for centuries, but at least in the modern form today, these folks think of it as a type of religion. It's just one that doesn't have a supernatural God to it, but it has a full set of values, as we saw, and it is something that they're trying to, or they think of as a religion. Here we see a quote from Horace Mann, who is one of the ones who's considered sort of a foundational to the our modern education systems. I believe, if I'm not mistaken, he was born in the late 1700s. So long ago, just literally 20 years after the nation was founded, this man was born. But here's what he thought about religion. He said, what the church has been for medieval man, the public school must become for democratic and rational man. God would be replaced by the concept of the public good. So one of the points here is that humanism is certainly not new. And here we have these folks, and you can go do a lot of research on public education, and you'll run across names like Horace Mann, John Dewey, these others who are considered to be sort of foundational to our American education systems. And what were they thinking? Well, here's what they were thinking. They were thinking, well, God, we're going to replace God with the concept of the public good. So again, that's the ideal of humanism here. And they compare, the church is this outdated thing. We don't need that. We're going to move to humanism. Here we see another very well-known individual amongst education, folks that know about education, a man named John Dewey. John Dewey came out pretty clear. And by the way, he lived around the time of Charles Darwin. I did some quick research a little while back on him. But he lived during that time. He was very much enamored with Charles Darwin's work, which was had come out around that time, and he was involved with the college level education system, so training the teachers and what they're going to go out and teach. So he was very heavily involved in influencing the public school systems and the educators and their approaches to things. And so we again ask the question, well, what were John Dewey's philosophies? Well, he said there is no God, and there is no soul. Okay, so he didn't mince words about where he stood on religion, and so he says there's no need for the props of traditional religion. And so he says, with dogma and creed excluded, then immutable truth is also dead and buried. So he's saying there is no such thing as unchangeable truth. Except for maybe that one statement, I guess he wants that to be immutable. But besides that, he doesn't believe in changeable truth. He says there is no room for fixed natural law or moral absolutes. So he was one of these ones who, as we saw in some of the quotes last week, they want to be free from moral laws because they want to do what they want to do. And here we see that coming out in one of the top educators of our time. Now, here's a crazy quote. You would think this would be coming from some kook that comes from nowhere, but this is actually a quote from a Harvard professor of education. So, again, an institution that is training the future teachers and what they need to be, how they need to be approaching their jobs. And so They make this statement, every child in America entering school at the age of 5 is mentally ill. And he describes what he means by that. He comes to school with certain allegiances toward our founding fathers, toward our elected officials, toward his parents, toward a belief in a supernatural being, toward the sovereignty of this nation as a separate entity. So here is this, quote, mentally ill child that has all these preconceived notions about these things. And so what does he see then as the job of the teacher? Well, he says, it is up to you teachers to make all these sick children well by creating the international children of the future. So here's what's been going on in our so-called halls of higher education at little colleges like Harvard, right? You know, this has been going. This was a quote from 1984, so the year that I graduated high school, right? Where, and so this has been going on, and certainly that wasn't the first year they started that, guaranteed, and certainly it hasn't stopped ever since. So, you know, Harvard and all of these other institutions. Now, by the way, I believe John Dewey was from the University of Chicago. He was kind of in the same line here as a professor of education. So we've had all of these universities for literally 100 or more years that are churning out teachers that have been trained that this is your job, to go fix these sick children and to quit, get them to quit believing in supernatural beings, to quit being submissive to their parents, to quit worrying about the sovereignty of this nation. If you go read the Humanist Manifesto 2, you'll see there's discussion in there about one world global government. And again, we see that concept coming through here as well, where there's this idea that we're going to have this big, one happy world that's going to have this one government ruling over everyone. And of course, all these children that are being raised according to what the scriptures teach, that are following authority and believing in these supernatural beings called God, that believe there are moral absolutes, that they're completely not going to fit in with this idea of this one world government that these folks have. Here's an article from American Atheist back in 1977, and again, you know, trying to promote what they want to bring about in society. We must ask how we can kill the God of Christianity. We need only to ensure that our schools teach only secular knowledge. If we could achieve this, God would indeed be shortly due for a funeral service. So again, they're trying to think, how can we kill God? How can we remove God from society? And here the suggested path as well. Again, it's through our school systems, and let's make sure that our school systems are not teaching anything that is religious in nature. And of course, we see these very strong pushes being made. We see lawsuits coming from places like the ACLU that sue anytime a school makes an attempt to do anything like posting the Ten Commandments or you know, teaching anything remotely religious. That's a no-no, according to them. And we see the motive behind that right here. Here's another statement, pretty ugly statement as well. But they start out by, this was from the Humanist magazine in 1983, where he says, I'm convinced that the battle for humankind's future. Now, you would see that phrase and think, wow, this must be really important here. This is the battle for humankind's future. What is he going to talk about here? Well, he says it must be waged and won in the public school classroom by teachers who correctly perceive their role as proselytizers of a new faith, a religion of humanity. So this is what's needed in this battle for humankind's future. That's how important this is to them, to have this society without God. And they see this as a big battle. And they go on here to talk about how these teachers need to be these selfless individuals that are every bit as dedicated as the most rabid gospel preachers, fundamentalist preachers. And he talks about how they're going to be ministers of a different sort here. And they're utilizing the classroom instead of a pulpit to do what? To convey humanist values in whatever subject they teach, regardless of educational level, preschool, daycare, or a large state university. And we see that in our schools today. We see preschoolers being taught values and principles that are very much in contradiction to what the scriptures teach. And certainly it continues on from there. And so he goes on to say the classroom must and will become an area of conflict between the old and the new, the rotting corpse of Christianity, and the new faith of humanism. So here he's describing us, Christians, as a rotting corpse. We're this old medieval concept. They want us all dead, removed from society. Because there is this new faith now, and it's called humanism, a new religion in town, right? And so, you know, we need to ask the question, when we see statements like this, and some of these from folks in pretty powerful positions, right? Think about if you're that college professor that's teaching that children, every child at the age of 5 is mentally ill. I mean, here you are, you're teaching this, you're teaching every day, you're teaching hundreds of students every year, year after year. I mean, that's a pretty powerful influence, if you think about it, over some key areas of our society. And they understand that. And they make these statements, and we should ask ourselves, what do I think about these statements? I mean, do these kinds of statements alarm us? And certainly, they should alarm us very much. Another area that we need to realize is also part of their intention is to influence religious organizations. They actually wrote about this in the very first Humanist Manifesto. They said, humanism maintains that all associations and institutions exist for the fulfillment of human life. So they see everything. The reason for existence for every institution is ultimately for human fulfillment, right? Human life. That includes religious churches, right? Religious institutions. And so they talk here, they say the intelligent evaluation, transformation, control, and direction of such associations and institutions with a view to the enhancement of human life is the purpose and program of humanism. So they put this manifesto out declaring what they're going to be trying to do. And they talk about how they need to evaluate and transform all of these institutions, and that includes religious institutions, and they make that clear. They say, certainly, religious institutions, their ritualistic forms, ecclesiastical methods, and communal activities must be reconstituted. Well, what is a constitution? A constitution is what declares the what that organization does. We know how important the Constitution of the United States is. Well, of course, we would consider our Constitution to be what? The Bible, right? Well, here, their view is all this needs to be, we all need to be reconstituted. We need to throw away that old Constitution and have another one. And so there, and this, again, is in the context of religious institutions. So we might wonder, well, how are they going to achieve that? How is a humanist going to come in and affect a religious organization? I mean, they're completely, you know, opposed to religion. They're trying to remove God. How can they possibly be an influence on religion? And a side note here, maybe to point out, is that remember Charles Potter was a co-author of the first manifesto, this, in 1933. He was also a Baptist preacher. And he was known as a progressive Baptist preacher. Somewhere along the way, he decided that he was a little bit too progressive for the Baptists, and so he became a Unitarian preacher. If you ever do a little bit of research into the Unitarians, a lot of their thought is very humanistic in nature. But he was actually even a little bit too progressive for them, so he eventually left the Unitarian church as well, and went on to found the humanist societies and so on and so forth. So, but certainly imagine what Charles Potter would have preached when he was a preacher in the Baptist Church and the Unitarian Church. But again, we ask the question, well, how are they going to influence religious organizations? Well, there's some interesting research that Daryl and Ruth Hansen are actually a couple of a brother and sister in Christ that I believe were from Texas, and they did some research on humanism and its impact to Sunday schools. But one of the things that they found in their research is you might, especially some in here who have been Bible class teachers in the past, there's these religious publishing houses. I don't recall some of the exact names off the top of my head, but you can go online and you can find these publishing houses that have Bible class curriculums and things like that. And you might notice that a lot of them have kind of common themes to them. And you might even notice that sometimes when it comes summertime and there's the VBSs going on, and you'll see even different denominations that somehow have VBSs about the same thing. And you might wonder, well, how did that happen? Well, a lot of times it's because they're drawing from common sources like this, these publishing houses that are influenced by places like this, the Religious Education Association. And so this organization has been around for a long time, and it has a lot to do with putting together Bible school curricula that are used all over the world. Now, what's more interesting is who was part of the founding of that organization. It was founded by many of the same founders as the National Education Association, and that included John Dewey. Does anybody remember one of the quotes that we just read from John Dewey a minute ago? He said, "There is no God and there is no soul. Hence, there is no need for the props of traditional religion." And he went on to be a co-signer of the First Humanist Manifesto, right? And he had these views. And you have to ask yourself, well, why would he be interested in being a founder here of the Religious Education Association? Well, again, these folks have some motives. They have some agendas. They want to exert some influence and steer society in the way that they're hoping for it to go. And so we need to realize when we're thinking about methods that the devil uses, these are methods, right? You get someone with a bad motive, and you put them in the right institution, and they can corrupt a tremendous amount of individuals. And so we need to recognize that, again, this is not just a passive philosophy that exists in the world that people are free to choose from. There's a lot of money behind this, and a lot of influential leaders that have been working on this for well over 100 years. Again, Horace Mann was born back in 1796. So, these folks that have this mindset have been around for almost as long as our country has. One of the secular humanist, some of the literature, there's an article in there that talks about more about theology and kind of what they're trying to do as they are trying to reconstitute the churches here. And so one of their goals here is, they say, liberal theology puts man's needs central, okay? And what do they mean by that? Well, they talk about putting welfare programs and human rights campaigns and feeding the poor and caring for the sick, righting the wrong, as kind of the focus of the church. And at first you might say, well, what's wrong with that? What's wrong with feeding the poor and caring for the sick? I mean, Jesus in Matthew 25 called out both of those things as very important things that will be brought up on the day of judgment. And so most people would look at a statement like that and say, well, what's wrong with caring for the poor and feeding the poor and caring for the sick? And the subtlety here is that what they're trying to do is to make that the focus of the church. And we need to understand the distinction. When we're trying to follow the scriptures, we understand that the scriptures are trying to show us how to have the mind and the heart of our Lord Jesus Christ. And when we come to have that mind and heart of Christ, what is it going to naturally cause us to do? Well, it's going to naturally cause us to care for the sick and feed the poor and do some of these other things, okay? And maybe to illustrate it further, we think about, well, what is the difference? We're having trouble with the... See if it's... I'm showing as being connected. Okay. So we need to recognize the subtlety here, that it's kind of, imagine, I mean, we all know that folks like, you know, Bill Gates feeds the poor. Bill Gates does things with his organizations that they care for the sick, okay? But how does the Lord see Bill Gates versus how does the Lord see Christians? Is the Lord going to view them differently, or is he just going to, is the Lord on Judgment Day going to say, well, look, Bill Gates did all these good things, enter into the gates of heaven here. That's not going to happen as long as Bill Gates continues to have the mind that he's openly stated, right? Bill Gates said he has no time for religion, right? His motive is not out of love. It's not out of obedience to doing the Lord's will, okay? So you can have two people, they might be doing the very same outward work, but the motive and the heart behind it is completely, it can be completely opposite, right? Because again, we're seeing that these humanists are doing some of the very same works that we do. I mean, you could probably argue that they're doing it to a greater extent than a lot of us, right? They've got a lot more money behind it, and so they're probably feeding a lot more poor than any of us in here will ever have opportunity to do. However, again, it's the heart behind the action that the Lord is also seeing, right? And so the average person sees a statement like this and they think, oh, the humanists are good. They're doing a lot of good here. And it leads to that slogan we saw earlier, you can be good without God. They see these outward things and they think, well, that's true. Look how they're doing all this good. But we need to recognize that there's a huge difference here between having the focus on doing the outward actions versus changing the heart, as we are taught in the Scriptures. We realize that changing the heart happens to result in a lot of these good things as well, but the focus of the Scriptures is on transforming us, and we need to recognize that difference, that the focus of the Scriptures is not on the outward things. Remember what was the warning that Jesus gave to the Pharisees, the thing he told them they needed to do first? What was that? What was it that they needed to do first? Another pop quiz question. Clean the inside, and then what was going to happen if they did that? That what? That the outside would be clean also, okay? So their outward works were going to come about as a result of what was on the inside. And so, again, the Scripture's focus is on the inner man that leads to the correct outward actions, but it doesn't work the other way around. Doing the right outward actions doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what's on the inside. And we see that with these humanists. And they understand, they're smart enough, Satan is smart enough to understand that difference. And so he's got this philosophy where they realize if we could just get all these churches to just focus on the outside, what are they really doing? They're really creating a bunch of Pharisees, right, that are doing these works on the outside, but on the inside their heart is far from God, what it's supposed to be. So Satan here understands that distinction, and the ones that are sold on this philosophy of humanism then are trying to reconstitute the churches to, as it says here at the last sentence, to make the message of Christ serve humanity. That's they're trying to get the churches focused on, you know, going after all these programs that help humanity rather than focusing on the inward man. We read this earlier, but just to to remind us, you know, these folks are going to great lengths, we see, to promote this philosophy and to promote this kind of society. And we need, again, to remind ourselves of this isn't new, but the methods are perhaps a little bit changed in our modern times, but the same guiding motives have been around for a long, long time, as we see here from the passage in Psalm 2, where the Lord asks the question, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine the vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. And then it goes on to talk about how they want to break these bands that God is trying to impose on them so that they can be free. And of course, in the end, they're not going to win. The Lord is going to have them in derision, as we see here in Psalm 2. But we see the methods that these folks are trying to employ to persuade our world to follow Satan. And again, we need to remind ourselves of what Ephesians chapter 6 teaches us, that the battle is with Satan. And Satan is using these powers that he mentions here. And so we need to remember, we're wrestling not flesh and blood here. It's these humanist people and things like that, but behind all of that is Satan and is the work that he's accomplishing through them as his tools. And so we're wrestling against, as he says here, these principalities and powers and rulers of the darkness of the world and against spiritual wickedness in high places. And as we've seen from time to time through some of these quotes, sometimes it takes some discernment to pick out from these statements that are being made, well, what's wrong with that? And then we realize, well, this is what's wrong with some of these statements that we're seeing here. Just a couple of other things to note here about humanism, just to kind of summarize. When you go to their websites and you look at the things that they're really promoting and celebrating, you find things like this, where they literally celebrate homosexuality, for example. And we might recall that homosexuality is one of those things that the Lord speaks of in Romans chapter 1 that we've read both in John's lesson as well as mine last week. Romans 1, where the Lord has given us this creation and he expects everyone to conclude when they look at this creation that there is a God. And yet there are these ungodly individuals that don't want that because they want to do what they want to do. And that includes a long list of sinful things that the Lord lists there at the end of Romans chapter 1, one of which is what we see here. And so it's interesting. The Lord has this very explicit list, these ones who will not accept him as God, and how he's given them over to a reprobate or an unapproved mind, as he describes there in Romans chapter 1, to do these things. And he explicitly calls out homosexuality in Romans chapter 1. And yet, we see another example from humanism of where they are just diametrically opposed to what we're taught in the scriptures. And we see their statements that they post for all the world to see. They're not hiding their views on these things. And they say, well, they reject the notion of sin and guilt. Those are just superstitious notions. And they say, especially in relation to sexual ethics. So they want to be very free to practice these activities. And so they make these statements, and promote these sort of sister organizations such as this LGBTQ Humanist Council. There's a lot of affiliated organizations that humanism very openly associates itself with, and they make statements like this on their sites to embrace the position of these kinds of organizations. We find companies all over the world that are bought into these things. Just a few years ago, I remember, or there happened to be, whatever day this was, I think it was in June, because June is the month that everybody celebrates this. this perversion. You know, when you see these things like, you know, where Google puts up the rainbow as part of their search engine and things like that, and it's just these messages that permeate all kinds of places in our society where they celebrate these kinds of things. And it's certainly not limited to the U.S. A lot of the quotes and things in here are from the American Humanist Association, but again, we saw last week a list posted at one of their sites that shows all the different countries where these same organizations exist. And so we think a lot of times about these pride marches, so-called pride marches. A lot of times I think a lot of us instantly think San Francisco, because that was kind of a place that adopted those kinds of things very early on. But the very same things happen in places like India as well. It's happening all over the world where they not only practice these things, but they revel in these things, and they openly are proud of their immorality, and they're trying to get the world to accept their immorality. Here's another stance, their stance on drugs. They basically make this statement that says, well, the U.S. policy is based on an assumption. Okay, well, what is the assumption they're saying that U.S. law policy is based on? Well, they're saying that we're assuming that drugs cause crime and corruption and disease. And so we label them as bad and we ban them. And they go on to say, well, that creates all these you know, underground activities that go on and so on and so forth. And so what do they suggest? Well, what they say is, well, the problem is what really causes crime is drug prohibition. So when you have drug prohibition, it creates this illegal black market. It creates all these underground activities. It creates crime and disease. And so what are they suggesting here? Well, they're suggesting to legalize drugs. You know, they're what they're trying to argue here, pretty unsuccessfully, I think. But what they're trying to argue is, well, if you don't make it illegal, it won't be a crime anymore. Well, that's kind of obvious, but it's interesting. You know, there's been communities like Portland and others that have actually gone so far as to do that, and recently they've had to rescind those decisions because it doesn't work out well. I made several over the course of my business travels. I made a lot of trips to Portland, and it was bad enough when it was still illegal. The streets downtown were just filled with drug addicts. It was unbelievable, and I can't imagine what happened when they legalized it for a period of time. But now they've gone back because it was out of control. But, you know, you have these very progressive individuals that are trying to promote these things like legalization of these illicit drugs. I'm sure no one is surprised to see that humanism supports a woman's supposed right to have an abortion, and they make these public assertions that they stand by, you know, Roe versus Wade, and the so-called woman's right of choice, as they say here. Shouldn't surprise us at all. We might want to go back to some of their earlier statements. You know, we might recall from last week where they claim to be a philosophy of compassion. Well, you could maybe argue that they're being, quote, compassionate to the woman here, but you also might ask the question, what about to the unborn child in the woman's womb? What about the compassion there? You know, it's I think we all obviously understand that, well, there's no compassion there. That's murder, right? And so they make these statements, and they talk about, you know, feeding the poor, feeding the hungry, helping the poor, all of these social programs. They talk about the positives. They talk about, when they talk about things like abortion, they talk about how they're trying to help the women here. But they conveniently leave off some of the other details. Well, what about the unborn child and what's happening to the unborn child and so on? So they're very selective in what they define as being good. Remember, we talked over and over last week about how their stance is, well, you can be good without God. Well, their definition of good is very, very different than God's definition of good. And we see while there might be some things that actually appear good, there's an awful lot of things that are not good at all. And we've just looked at two or three here. Here's another one, which is the principle of euthanasia, right? And so again, and this is a statement that comes from the second Humanist Manifesto, published in 1973, where they make it clear that they recognize an individual's right to die with dignity, euthanasia, and the right to suicide. So, again, they're not worried about any of the scriptures that we read where it says, well, who is it that maintains and has the right to give life and to take life? It's the Lord. And obviously, you know, we've seen plenty of statements that they're not concerned about what God wants here. And so they're certainly ready to take that role upon themselves. And we see that a lot of decisions and directions being pushed in our society today where they're very freely making these kinds of decisions about life and death and people's right to do these things like killing themselves and so on. So they have these statements that they put out as well. So we need to recognize that when we look at some of their statements, while they talk about being good, we recognize it's very, very arbitrary. The things, it's all whatever suits humanity's desires. It has nothing to do with what our Creator says is right or wrong. It's simply what satisfies the human need here. And so if it's convenient and a woman doesn't want to have a child, then that's let her do what she wants to do. It doesn't matter whether the child is being murdered or not. It's all about what this person wants. And so, you know, we see these great contradictions, right, where they're working, you know, towards some things that most people would call and consider to be good. But then, on the other hand, they're fighting for these things that we just saw. They're fighting for you know, sexual immorality. They're fighting for abortion. They're fighting for euthanasia. They're fighting to legalize drugs. Pretty much every kind of social issue like that you could think of, they're on the wrong side of it because they want human freedom to go about and do as they please. So I hope this will help folks to be at least a little bit more aware about the fact that, you know, there are forces at work, particularly that Satan, but he's got a lot of ones who have signed up to participate and to be willing to be used to carry out these kinds of philosophies and such things as this. And so we need to be on the lookout, realizing that there's a lot going on that we may not have thought about before. And we need to be watching out for ourselves, and we need to be watching out for our children as well. We're going to flip over to another presentation here in a second, but does anybody have any questions, comments about what we've talked about so far? All right, give me just a second to flip over, do a different introduction to another topic that we're going to go into. Can't find my mouse pointer. It's disappeared on me. Decided to come back. So the next area that we're going to go into here has to do with some of the evidences that have to do with the existence of God. So we're going to try to talk about some of those types of evidences first, and then as time goes on, we'll get more into the evidences that we can use to combat some of the things that we're being told about things like evolution. But first, we really want to focus on that basic question: does God exist, and what are the evidences that we have to be able to argue that? Remember, we talked in an earlier lesson about the definition of faith, and when you look up that literal definition, it literally means to be convinced by what? To be convinced by argument, right? So it's like being in a courtroom where someone's trying to lay out an argument. Here's this and this and this evidence to consider in order to convince the judge and the jury of something, right? And so here we're talking about, well, how do we convince ourselves, and how do we convince others that there is a God? What is the evidence that we have for that? And we're going to use a term here that's used a lot in the realm of Christian evidences, and when you talk about these evidences, this term intelligent design is one that comes up quite a bit. And we're going to see it actually has a very, very scriptural basis to it. We'll get to that in just a minute. But the argument for intelligent design here is that there's evidence for design in the universe being everything, whether it's us as human life or the universe and the stars and the planets and so on. But the idea here is that where you find evidence of a design, it implies that there must be a what? It implies that there must be a designer to it. And of course, we deduce from that when we see order, when we see planning, when we see things that are very organized, and we see a design in a system, we realize, well, there must have been some intelligence behind this that decided to do it this way. There's someone who caused this to be this way, and that's kind of the idea here with intelligent design. But there's also a scripture, a passage in Hebrews chapter 3 and verse 4 that is this principle, where he says here, every house is builded by some man. When we're driving down the street, we see houses all over the place. We can look across the street, right? We look at that house, and what do we realize? Well, somebody built that house. It didn't just pop out of nothing. It didn't just happen by accident. It was built by some man, as it says here. He extends this principle to say, he that built all things is God. So, again, we have this teaching in the scriptures that tell us God has built, God has designed and built everything in the universe. And he's taking a principle that we can all see with our eyes, that we can look around and we can see a house and realize that some man built that. And then he's extending that principle to say, well, God built everything, and we need to recognize that. Think of some simple examples, right? Does anybody, now this is kind of a little tiny car, right? Probably a few of us could get together, pick it up, and carry it off. But nevertheless, is there any doubt that somebody designed that car? You know, in fact, there were hundreds of engineers that had to come together, spend a long time to design that car, small and simple as it is. Nobody's going to go look at that car and say, well, that car just popped into existence. That car just happened by chance. It's obvious that's not the case. There's many examples we could think of that way. If you're in Egypt and you're walking around and you pass this pillar with these symbols on the pillar here, would anybody suggest that it was just, you know, wind and rain, erosion over time that made these symbols on these pillars that you see in Egypt? Would anybody suggest that? Would anybody think that someone that did suggest that was being reasonable about anything? You know, we all understand it would be ridiculous to say that the wind and the rain just accidentally, randomly carved out this very intricate pattern of obvious symbols here, right? We all know that someone was behind this. And all it takes is a look, right? What about this? Here's a simple thing like a bush, right? Does anybody in here, would anybody believe that this bush just happened to grow like this over time? It just, you know, you got millions of bushes. This would kind of be the way an evolutionist would say it. You've got billions of bushes, and this one just randomly happened to come out like this. There's lots of other shapes in the other bushes, but this one happened to come out looking like a dinosaur. Is that what anybody would suggest? You know, we all, again, realize what a ridiculous statement that would be. What about music? Would anyone say that this set of notes on this page just happened when somebody knocked over an ink pen and it spilled out on the paper and suddenly we have these notes here? You know, we all, again, realize there's amazing organization here, amazing level of design to how these notes come together and the sound that they make. And we realize, well, that just doesn't happen by time and chance. It doesn't matter how long the time. In a billion years or 100 billion years, would any of us expect to see something like this happen? We all understand that doesn't make any sense. What about this painting? Anybody know what this painting is? The Mona Lisa, right? Very famous painting. Did anybody think that this guy named Leonardo just happened to spill some paint on a canvas one day and this came out? Is that what happened? Could that happen after, you know, a billion years? I mean, if he just, imagine Leonardo could just live on and on through time and he kept knocking over ink bottles or paint trays. Would this eventually come about, you know, if he just kept doing this for billions of years or trillions of years? You know, we understand there's an organization here of elements that doesn't happen by time and chance, no matter how long. And so we realize that this particular arrangement of these colors and textures, there's a design behind it. There's an intelligence behind it. And it happens to be an intelligence that, you know, not a whole lot of people possess in that particular case. Here's another example. Anybody know where this is from? Easter Island, okay. Does anybody know who made these? Last I heard, they're still scratching their heads. They don't know exactly where these came from. But is there any question... you know, any question what? That somebody made them? I mean, does anybody think that, again, time and chance, you know, the wind over time, it just, you know, happened to erode away these rocks and they happen to have these faces like this? You know, and all the faces seem to be similar on these rocks. That's kind of comparable to evolutionists saying, well, you have to have a male that evolved and a female that evolved over these billions of years in parallel in order to, you know, have humankind continue on after that, right? Well, here's all these individual statues that if you were of that mindset, you would be arguing that, well, the wind just happened to erode this stone this way. And it happened to do that same thing for all these other stones at exactly the same time. Isn't that amazing? That's kind of a ridiculous notion, isn't it? So again, we see a design, an organization to things, even to rocks, right? It doesn't have to be something complicated. It can be a bush or a rock. And we can see pattern and organization to it and realize that there is some intelligence behind that in some way. The same is true of Stonehenge, right? We've all heard of Stonehenge. Many years ago, scientists came together to study Stonehenge. And they concluded a lot of interesting things about Stonehenge. Mostly that it they believe that these rocks are set up in this, you know, concentric pattern. There's holes and then there's rocks. And they believe that they were set up to be able to make astronomical calculations, predictions of when certain astronomical events would happen. They studied that. They made that conclusion after a lot of study. However, there's still a lot of questions about Stonehenge that they don't know the answer to. Still don't. Just like the Easter Island statues, right? There's a lot of things we don't know about those. There's a lot of things we don't know about Stonehenge. They really have to wonder about how, you know, some ancient people was able to arrange these massive stones in this way. What exactly was the data that they were collecting from this, and how did they use it? So there's all kinds of questions that the scientists came up with. They made some conclusions that were perhaps helpful, but they still have a lot of questions. But one thing they don't have a question about is that there was some intelligent design behind these rocks. These rocks didn't just happen to, you know, stand up on their own like this. The ocean didn't come in and just happen to wash these rocks into some nice concentric arrangement that happens to be very useful for making astronomical calculations. They went there with the complete understanding that, well, somebody made this arrangement. We don't know who it was. We don't know exactly what they did with it. We don't even know how they necessarily put this together, but we know that there was an intelligence behind it. And so we can look at these simple things. Some of these were silly examples that we can look at. It's obvious that there's a designer behind these things, but we need to then extend that to our entire universe and to life and ask the question, well, when we see the complexity in this universe, and when we see the complexity and the organization in life, and Brother John has some lessons coming up on that particular topic, when we see the complexity here, what conclusion are we going to make when we see that? Are we going to conclude that, well, this all just came about as an accident through random chance over time, over billions of years, and random processes happening is how we came about? You know, that's what evolution wants to argue. You know, the universe itself. These atheists obviously don't believe in God. There is no God according to them, but they have to have some way to explain the universe. How did this universe get here? And, you know, they want to claim that it was through this massive Big Bang explosion that happened. And then they have this, you know, further explanations of how life then came about later in time. But, again, we want to think about some of these really simple examples that we saw. Some of them weren't so simple. I mean, the Mona Lisa or some of these other examples are not simple at all, right? They're pretty complex, and there's very few people in the world that could, with their intelligence, that would have the ability to reproduce those kinds of works. But then we think about, well, what about the universe and life? You know, it's an absurd thought, really, to think there's really no comparison to these simple things that we just discussed. When we look at the complexity of the universe and the complexity of life, and we ask and apply the same argument, right? Well, what is it telling us when we see all this complexity? Well, again, we realize there's an intelligence behind these things that we see. And then we have to ask the next question, well, what kind of intelligence could have made what we see and observe in the universe or in the human body or in animals or so many other facets of our universe? And that's what the next few presentations are going to go into, is really just to remind us of some of the incredible complexity that we have in these things, and to help us understand, well, there's an intelligence behind these things. There's no way that these things could have come about through some kind of random process. It can't happen with the simple things, and certainly when we start talking about the universe, it's even that much more absurd to think that it could have happened by accident there. So hopefully that's kind of our introduction to what's coming, Lord willing, next week and beyond for the next few weeks. And appreciate everybody's attention. Do we have any questions or comments or complaints? All right.